Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me, as always, the lovely Nadia Oxford.
Hello, how is everybody doing? Not that you can answer me.
And we are recording on the release of the greatest RPG of them all, Nadia.
That is a controversial statement, but yes, it is an important day in RPG history.
Oh, are you talking about Final Fantasy VII? I was talking about football. It's back, baby. Strategies and stats and fantasy. Oh, man, it's time. What were you talking about?
I was talking about Final Fantasy. That was a pretty funny exchange.
Yes, it is football season, and I am ready to smash beer cans against my head and jump up all over the place while my team loses and stuff. So.
Well, that's part of the fun, just kind of backing them even as they lose. I should know, as someone who lives in Toronto.
I've said in the past, people always think that I'm a unicorn because I happen to like RPGs and sports. Let me tell you something, Nadia, they are kind of the same dang thing. I am writing an article today, in fact, about fantasy football and how there's so many similarities, and yet fantasy stinks. I hate it.
Like fantasy versus, like, say, sci-fi, for example? Like, you don't like swords and sorcery?
No, fantasy football, Nadia. Fantasy football.
You're saying fantasy football sucks?
Yeah, it's terrible. I hate it because it looks like an RPG, but it's not actually an RPG. You're just playing the stock market. You're playing futures.
So it's not quite RPG enough, even though I think in our last podcast I called it like an RPG, and it's totally not.
If Final Fantasy VII were about recruiting people from all over Midgar and then selling high on them, that would be fantasy. It would be much closer to fantasy football.
That's a very interesting concept for Final Fantasy VII, if not disturbing.
Selling high on Aeris.
Well, I'd sell Ketchy in 2 seconds. That punk never enters my party ever.
Well, you know, Aeris gets the healing staff or whatever, or she gets her ultimate weapon before the halfway point of the game, which should be your warning that she's about to become weak, but she has a really good growth curve and good healing and everything, and then bam,
she's
dead.
Gone.
Oh, by the way, that's not a spoiler anymore. It's been 20 years.
Yeah.
By the way, Darth Vader is Luke's dad.
Holy crap. Are you kidding me?
I did manage to remain unspoiled on Fight Club's big twist.
Oh, did you? Oh, good job.
Yeah, but that, you know, that was like 2005.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally watched it, but I managed to remain unspoiled on it for like 6 years before I finally watched that movie. But as I think on this podcast, so I've said that I was actually spoiled on Final Fantasy VII's big twist before it even came out here.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that, but I can't remember how it went down.
It came out in Japan in January of 1997. And so the internet was a thing by 1997, and the people who were importing it and playing it were spoiling it, and my friend, who was paying careful attention to Final Fantasy VII at that time, totally told me about the big spoiler, and of course, at the time, it didn't mean anything to me. I was like, okay, yeah, whatever,
but the commercial,
of course,
spoiled it, too.
Did it?
I don't know if you remember, but the commercial like kind of showed a whole bunch of cinema scenes from the game, and one of them was just dead Aeris in the water.
My recollection of the TV ad, which I remember actually fairly clearly, is that it repeatedly flashes to scenes of the train.
I don't remember that one.
Like rushing forward on the tracks in Midgar, and then it flashes back to the title, and it goes, Final Fantasy VII!
I do not remember that. I do remember our buses had ads like for the games, like calling out Nintendo, basically saying like they were dead because Final Fantasy VII was coming.
I remember that there was a magazine ad with the Junon cannon.
I think that was the one. Yes, it was on our buses.
That was a big shot. That was taking a big shot against Nintendo.
Yeah.
The reason we're talking about so much about Final Fantasy VII is we are recording it, in fact, on the 20th anniversary of the release of Final Fantasy VII in the U.S. Woo. And we'll talk about it for a moment or two, but oh my God, I feel like we've talked about Final Fantasy VII so much on this podcast over the years. But if you want to talk even more about it, or at least read some more, you know, a few months ago, Jeremy Parrish wrote a really nice 6-part series about Final Fantasy VII for US Gamer as part of his Design and Action series, and you should go totally check it out. I re-promoted it not too long ago. You can go find it on the site.
Yes, and I'll be writing something today too. It'll be up, of course, by the time this is up, but you should read that too. Message from the future.
Literally the second comment that I got on that, by the way, was, why would you spoil the game in the description?
I really hope that's a joke.
To all the people listening to this podcast, you don't know that Aerith dies as the central twist? I don't know what
like
to tell you.
It's like a joke in pop culture by now.
No, it totally is, at least in gaming culture.
Yeah, totally.
I feel like it's part of the zeitgeist at this point.
Yeah,
but, you know, can I just say, Nadia, that you don't have to be spoiler-free to enjoy a product.
No,
because
of course
context not. Is everything.
It absolutely is. I spoil so much crap for myself, but I still manage to enjoy it. It's rare that the only game I would say go in with as few spoilers as possible is Undertale. But even then, like, it's not a huge deal. As you say, context is everything. I rarely find myself disappointed when I'm like, oh, I know about this twist.
I think the flip side is I don't watch movie trailers anymore.
No, I guess because they have too many spoilers in them, eh?
No, it's more that I just don't want to know anything. I want to go in totally blind. I want to have the maximum amount of surprise, because one of the most satisfying movie going experiences I ever had was when I went to Kill Bill in 2003, not knowing anything.
That would be
How about that movie?
Yeah.
Literally nothing, except that it is a movie by Tarantino and everybody is praising it, so I guess I'll go see it or something. And coming out going, wow, that was amazing. I love this movie so much. That was so cool. Like, it hit 5 times as hard because I didn't know anything about that movie.
That's interesting. How did you avoid any spoilers about that movie or anything?
It was 2003, pre-social media, and it was much easier to avoid information like that back in the day.
Oh, God, it was 2003, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Oh, Jesus, Murphy.
We didn't even have Facebook at that time.
I was alive for a huge chunk, of course, the pre-internet age, but it's hard to even think back to, wow, no Facebook, no Twitter. How do we survive? In blissful ignorance, I guess.
I would say that we survived a heck of a lot better than we do now,
yeah.
Because social media is a blight that needs to be destroyed.
We have some nice people who talk to us.
I mean, yes, it's true. But broadly speaking, social media is a social ill that really needs to be nuked from the face of the planet. And that's Kat Bailey hot take of the day.
Hot take of the day. Come back every day for a hot take by Kat Bailey.
So last week we had Josh Sawyer on the podcast to talk about Pillars of Eternity, Nadia. And this week, Josh is going to be back again for another interview, this one also with Fergus Urquhart, who is one of the founders of Obsidian and was at Black Isle back in the day. And it is for our retrospective on Fallout New Vegas,
which is
going live on Monday. Yes, it was part of a trip to Obsidian that I took. It would have been last month, about a month ago at this time. We did it as kind of a joint thing with Eurogamer and RPS and all of them. And I really wanted to kind of just... Everybody has talked a lot about Fallout New Vegas's kind of troubled development and how it nearly killed the studio and the whole famous Metacritic thing where they missed 1 point.
Oh.
They were 1 point below the threshold they needed to hit to be paid out on all of their bonuses and everything.
Oh, I hate that crap. I forgot it was that game that you hear about that, like, you know, the whole bonus thing and Metacritic and how, you know, developers are bound to it. And I knew there was one game that was specifically cited for it, and I forgot it was Fallout New Vegas.
It's Fallout New Vegas. But it has become a classic. Mm-hmm, everybody absolutely loves Fallout New Vegas and consistently cite it as one of the best games in the series, usually when they're bashing Fallout 4. And I wanted to kind of dive deep into what makes that game a classic. Mm-hmm. Why it resonates with people so much, why people really love that game. And the interview touches on some of that, touches on some of the making of the game, goes into a lot of the best quests, like the cannibalism quest, which is one of the best RPG quests I've ever played. It's so good. So, and then, of course, you can look forward to the retrospective on Monday. So, in any case, and we'll also talk a little bit about Final Fantasy VII, The New Tyranny, Bastard's Wound expansion, and also really quickly about the news about South Park's difficulty slider. Did you see that, this, Nadia?
I did, yes. That's pretty funny.
Oh my gosh. So, okay. South Park, the Butthole of Time's main way that they depict a difficulty slider is the easiest is white and the hardest is black.
Yeah.
Like dark, dark, dark skin. And I gotta say, that is bold.
That is pretty bold. I know we've like kind of cut up their politics before, and they deserve to have their politics cut up. But that doesn't mean once in a while that they are spot on with stuff like that. I mean, they have addressed white privilege in the past in one of their episodes. I don't know if you remember the Naggers episode.
Oh God, yes. I joke about that one a lot.
Yeah,
actually.
And Stan was trying to apologize to Token, named Token, of course. And Token's telling him over and over again, you don't get it, you don't get it. And the episode only ended favorably when Stan realized, as a white person, he can't understand what a black person goes through. So he said to Token, you're right, I don't get it. And Token says, now you get it. And that was
it. Yeah, pretty much. Look, we're not going to get too political on this podcast. I am not a big believer in stick to games or stick to sports.
Yeah, that's impossible.
I do think that one of the most troubling issues that is facing this country right now is the brutality with which the black community is being treated on a routine basis, and how we are consistently turning our eyes away from it. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to kind of put it out there in the media is, rather than getting all preachy, as some people like to accuse South Park of doing, but to make them laugh, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
And if there's any genre that can kind of do that, I think it's RPGs.
Yeah, I guess RPGs have, RPGs have been political for the longest time. I mean, I talk all the time about the Breath of Fire series, and Breath of Fire 2, when I go back to it, I realize how basically it's a statement against, you know, pushing out native religions in favor of, like, you know, Christian religion and all this stuff. And I really wish I had a better translation, but there's a whole message of colonialism and, like, you know, old gods being killed off for new gods. And it was really interesting. It was a very interesting RPG to go through at the time, because the ESRB had just made it possible. There's no way Nintendo would have let that through before you could give a rating to games, but it happened. So it was my first really heavy RPG. And again, I really wish it had a better translation.
It's weird to say this because of how much I slammed the South Park folks for their politics in the past, but I trust them a lot more than, say, Ken Levine to have a kind of a cogent argument to make in their game, even as they're being really gross and making, like, lots of body jokes and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, sometimes they get it very wrong and sometimes they get it very right. They're not, like, really, they're not wishy-washy in the way that, like, Ken Levine could be like, hey, both sides are really bad. It's like, ugh, come on, guy. You should know better.
BioShock Infinite's argument is just one of the most cretinous things I've ever seen in a video game.
Yeah, but it did have, like, this sort of really upbeat mix of everybody wants to rule the world, like vaudeville. Everybody wants to rule our world. I'm like, oh, man, that's awesome. But yeah, the message was terrible.
Wipe away the debt. And then, of course, meanwhile, Kojima always had a more gonzo approach to politics in games. It wasn't an RPG.
That's true.
But actually, one of my favorite things in Metal Gear Rising is the final boss is a U.S. senator with superpowers, who's the supervillain. It's pretty great.
I never played that game. I always meant to. It looked like it was just a ton of fun.
Oh, it's pretty amazing. And it's one of Platinum's secret best games. It's a little short. But I would strongly recommend MGS Rising. I really liked it.
It looks like it's just, like, out of this world and crazy, but in a really fun way.
Yes. Oh, no, it was totally out of this world and crazy. And, of course, Kojima loved to tweak American politics to varying degrees of success in the Metal Gear series. But, unfortunately, video games aren't very good at handling politics in an interesting and mature way. They tend to be rather broad.
They're certainly bad the way they depict things. They have yes. problems with subtlety.
Yeah, what a shock. It is video games. So, but, a lot of people say that South Park got a little too political in the past few years, especially around the time of the election. But so we will have to see whether that ends up being reflected in the actual game.
Yeah, I guess we will. It's coming out quite soon.
All right, indeed. Another thing that is just coming out today, I believe, Tyranny's Bastard's Wound expansion. Unfortunately, Nadia, not getting too good of reviews.
Oh, that's too bad. I like the name.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good name. It's a reference to a village that is just outside the old walls. And it is there that you can get some quests and everything. The thing that people are kind of complaining about is the fact that it takes place in, like, Act 2 rather than being endgame content.
Oh.
Which is always the worst thing when you're playing a DLC. If you've already finished the game, you don't want to go back to a quest from earlier. You want to do an endgame quest or something that extends the storyline, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of want to... You've said goodbye to the characters, and you kind of want to go back and see them again. So there's something kind of unsettling about just kind of going back further and getting yourself back into that mindset, wedging yourself into that act.
It reminds me of anime movies that are completely untethered from the main story or just a side story. And so they don't add to the story much at all. They're just a fun romp that happens to have really good animation. The Cowboy Bebop movie is a prime example of this, where it's totally inessential. You don't have to watch it at all, but it's there, I guess, if you want more Cowboy Bebop.
And 99% of Dragon Ball Z movies.
There are Dragon Ball Z movies? Of course there are
Z movies. Most of them are except the one that kind of does Trunks' past. That one, I really like that one. Other than that,
Meanwhile, in the Pokemon movies, Ash manages to catch literally every legendary ever introduced, but then ends up not being able to keep them in his team or ends up having to release him.
Right. And he can't hang on to a Butterfree. How's he supposed to hang on to a legendary?
You know, in a couple months, the new Pokemon movie, Pokemon I Choose You, is going to have a couple days in American movie theaters. I might go see it.
You know what? I think a lot of Americans are going to go see that, and they're all going to be our age.
Yeah, pretty much. And also, if you go, you can get a Pikachu with the Ash hat in Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon.
Oh, really? Like, you can get in Pokemon Go? I have three of those goddamn things.
Yes, I think they're great, and I want one, even though I never use Pikachu. It's a trophy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I think I've said this on the podcast, but one of the more shameful moments I've ever, or one of the more embarrassing moments I ever had was when I was living in Japan. I went to see the Pokemon movie when it came out there solely so I could get a Darkrai. And when I bought the movie ticket, I've never been more self-conscious in my life.
Really? I guess back then, it was like you didn't have too many adult fans, did you? It was all for like children.
Well, I mean, it was more a case of being in Japan. I feel like it's even much more for kids over there. Right. And everybody in that movie theater, and especially the movies. So everybody in that movie theater are families with kids, right?
Right.
And I sat in the very back. I downloaded my Darkrai and then stayed and watched the movie in Japanese and actually enjoyed myself, but was thinking to myself, yep, I am a grown-ass woman sitting in this movie theater watching a kid's movie just so that I could get the Darkrai. So
it was. I say it was for good cause, although this was it's interesting to hear that there was downloadable content back then, but I guess Japan is a little ahead of the time in that regard.
It was a brand new thing for sure. The concept of the mystery gift was introduced for the first time in Pokemon Diamond and Pearl.
Right.
And previously with Emerald and Ruby and Sapphire in the GBA, it was pretty annoying because the only way that you could get the downloadable mystery gifts, I believe, was if you took them to an event, you could plug it into a machine or something, right, and they would send it to you.
Right, that's how you got Mew.
Though, with Fire Red Leaf Green, they introduced the wireless attachment to your GBA, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and you could also download through that. Oh. But there was no connection to the internet. There right. was no way to download mystery gifts. It was only local wireless.
Wow! Like at some point, either you or I should write a thing about like evolution of like mystery gifts. That would be really interesting. Mm.
Yes, Diamond and Pearl was a big deal because it was the first time that you could play Pokemon on the internet, and that's that was right. when the community really took off in a lot of respects. Mm-hmm. And then you could also get mystery gifts on the internet.
Yeah.
Or in movie theaters.
As an adult.
But Tyranny's Bastard's Wound, it's being kind of regarded as inessential. And the unfortunate thing is that a lot of people seem to like Tyranny, but it didn't get much of a marketing push. Mm-hmm. And it ultimately kind of faded away. It didn't ultimately do that well. So
yeah, I think we talked about it on the podcast, of course, but didn't it come out at a time when there was just everything was cascading from every yes. pore of the world?
Yes, I think so. And I don't know. When I played it, it was good. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. I didn't like that they reduced the party size to 4. Mm-hmm. I thought the combat felt a little stiff for the most part. The story was interesting, but in a weird way, the art was almost a little too stylized. Mm-hmm. I prefer the kind of gritty experience of Pillars of Eternity, to be perfectly honest. And Pillars of Eternity felt much truer to its roots. I really liked the dungeon crawling experience. I loved the D&D style
yeah.
interludes where you were making choices. Tyranny was interesting in that you were always playing politics. I think that was the best part of it. But just the fact that Bastard's Wound takes place in the middle of the game makes me less inclined to do it. It's the kind of thing they do when they're planning on releasing a Game of the Year edition.
Right.
So that people who miss it come back and go, oh, look at all this extra content. And then they're playing through it and they can experience it organically. See also Mass Effect mm-hmm. or Dragon Age Inquisition. Anyway, Tyranny Bastard's Wound is out now on PC, and if you have not played Tyranny, I would still recommend it, and you should just pick up the expansion with it, and then you can have a little extra content. Mm-hmm. But, okay, last bit of discussion before we head into the interview. Nadia, you're writing an article that you called a little more personal for Final Fantasy VII, and really quickly, like, what's the personal angle that you were taking with it?
Well, there's two things about it. First of all, me kind of going over what it was like to be a Nintendo fan who only had money for the Nintendo 64, and kind of coming to terms with the fact that, after much denial, that Final Fantasy VII was not coming to the N64. I mean, I clung to
Did
that.
You really believe that it was coming out on
God,
the N64?
Yes. I clung to that picture, you know, the one of the silicon graphics machine of Lox, Terra, and Shadow, even though I knew in my heart that I was like, oh, this is an N64 game. See, here's the proof. And even though I knew perfectly well that N64 games did not look that good, even Nintendo's games did not look that good. And also just the fact that at that point in time, when had Square ever just done a direct sequel to one of its own games? Like, Final Fantasy VII would not star the characters of Final Fantasy VI. I knew that. But, you know, I just wanted to believe it for a while. But the truth came out in the wash, and I kind of had to save up for PlayStation as well, because I came to the realization, not just through Final Fantasy VII, but through other games, that CD gaming and cartridge gaming were very different experiences, and I was going to have to find a way to get my fix of both. Of course, I also had to convince my parents that I needed both a PlayStation and an N64, because they thought, like, one system was the same as another. Like, why are you wasting your money? Well, Mom, this one has CD, this one has a cartridge. Oh, I don't know. That's a waste of money.
So they were treating it like VCRs, right?
Exactly. Why do you need both? So eventually, I did get both, and what I'm kind of going into now is just the parts of the game that still I find very emotionally impactful, and It's funny to say that because we all make fun of Final Fantasy VII for having a bad translation, which it does, and having some silly story themes, which it does. Oh, there's just parts of it that still, like, just get me right where I live. And I could talk about some of them, but I don't know if I want to spoil my article. Oh, screw it. Just the part where you lose Aeris like an idiot. Like, whoops, Shinra took her. Let's go tell her mom. And Elmira is telling you about like how she found Aeris just like basically abandoned at the train station beside her dead mother. And Elmira was so lonely, she had no one else, so she took Aeris home. And something I realized as I got older is that's probably something that happened a lot in post-war Japan as well, because there are so many orphans and, you know, some, I bet many were probably just picked up and adopted right then and there. But
that's a good point.
Yeah. So that's something, again, I realized that I was older and I saw Grave of the Fireflies, etc.
I was about to say, I'm getting some serious Grave of the Fireflies vibes right here.
Train station? What a happy movie. It tells you how it ends right from the start, and it ain't a happy ending. But also the part where I really like the part of the game where I about to call him Squall, where Cloud has to find himself and kind of like find his true identity and who he was. He's an interesting character, and I think one thing that's unfortunate is that he's been like classified as an emo nobody by the fandom, and that's really not true. He's kind of a jerk. But that's only because he has nothing in the way of memories or personalities until he has to gain one for himself. And that's a major theme in Final Fantasy VII. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Parrish's piece covers that in detail as well. Again, I really wish it had a better translation, and that's one thing I'm looking forward to in the remake, if it ever comes to be.
I remember at the time the Labyrinthian storyline and all the loose ends being considered a positive rather than kind of a knock against it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we hadn't really had a game that was quote-unquote that deep before.
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree that it has so many loose ends and so many like weird labyrinth twists. And it is the kind of game where if I play it for... Like, I've played it millions of times, and as soon as I stop playing it, I forget the story completely. And I have to play it again before I remember everything.
Yeah, it took me a long time to really grasp all of the particulars of the story, especially because the Cloud and Zack thing is so confusing the first time you're playing it. You're going, wait a minute, so Cloud actually wasn't a soldier? Who's this Zack guy? What? Wait a minute, I thought he was with Tifa.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole sequence, which I think is kind of corny, where Cloud ends up kind of recombining with himself.
Yeah,
I always
like
hated that
so
sequence.
JRPG anime is just brilliant in that context.
They do that in Xenogears as well.
Oh,
uniting
surprised.
The id and the ego and the superego.
Well,
and that sequence literally goes 2 hours.
Oh, is that on the infamous second disc? I never played Xenoblade. I just heard that.
Oh yeah, it definitely does. It's just repeated clips over to Faye. Young Faye with his eyes kind of covered by his hair, covered in blood, grinning.
Cool.
Like, it just keeps going back to that over and over and over again for like 2 hours. My God.
Oh, geez. At least one thing you can say for Final Fantasy VII in that regard is that, you know, it doesn't try to, like, be all ego and id and stuff like that. It's just, hey, here's Cloud. He needs to find his identity. It's stupid, but it's pretty simple in that way of, like, you were just finding an identity for this dude.
One thing that... So Jeremy's final article was what happens when the good guys are kind of bad,
yeah.
And he was pointing out that they're terrorists.
They kind of are, yes, they definitely are.
And one of the comments that I really liked was he said, maybe Final Fantasy VII is more relatable in 2017 than I realized. As he pointed out, Barrett and the coal miners feel left behind, but also too is Rocket Town, which is a victim of failed promises and dreams. It makes sense that large portions of the general population ignore the damage being done to the planet in hopes of returning to better times. It makes sense that they believe Shinra will make their world great again, despite all the evidence showing otherwise. And then somebody adds, Kaiser Warrior adds, yeah, when you look at it, Final Fantasy VII is a very prominent backdrop of depressed relics of the old industry dealing with being replaced by more modern enterprise. Even to a somewhat lesser extent, Wutai, a once great nation reduced to little more than a tourist trap, an amusement for those who conquered them militarily and ultimately economically. Of course, the entire point of Wutai is that it's a stand-in for Japan itself.
That's what I've heard. And I I guess it is there in many regards. I think they were forced to demilitarize, and as you say, they are a tourist town where they're just for their traditions are there for everyone to kind of ogle at.
Yeah, but I really like the connections being made to Barrett's hometown and, say, the coal mining towns in West Virginia that feel, I don't know, left behind in a modern age and are kind of lashing out in a lot of respects.
Yeah, so, and the whole, you know, hey, let's ignore the damage we're doing to our planet, even though it's hard to ignore now. But just kind of...
Sorry, you go ahead.
Just kind of damaging our planet to scrape another day out of... Just kind of scrape by for another day.
We can rag on Final Fantasy VII kind of all we want. And I think there's plenty to rag on. And in some ways, a lot of the stuff that we found so amazing back in 1997 has become cliche. You know, everybody points to Final Fantasy VII as one of the examples of what a JRPG might look like, especially a quote-unquote more modern one. But I've always liked that there's actually quite a lot to unpack with this game. And that you can go down a lot of rabbit holes in dissecting it and analyzing it. And I feel like people might make fun of me for saying this, but I don't think a lot of games are that smart, to be honest. I think that so many of them are surface level. So many of them are just really slap you in the face with their themes and everything. See Bioshock Infinite again. And Final Fantasy VII, maybe it's not always successful, but they really were inspired to do something kind of crazy. And you look back on it and you go, man, what an ambitious game.
It really was ambitious. They really, Square had a mission to just kind of come on the into the new generation with a bang, and they sure did that.
Yeah. By the way, if you did not, a while ago, Matt Leone did a really fantastic oral history of Final Fantasy VII for Polygon, in which he spent like a year on. Which
2 years.
I wish I could just assign somebody to be like, okay, go work on this feature for 2 years. You have an unlimited budget, but
hey.
That's what you got when you have those sweet, sweet investors pouring money into your company. But yeah, we also had him on the podcast to talk a little bit about the making of. So if you go back in our archives, you should be able to find that. Lots of really good information about Final Fantasy VII. But I think needless to say, it's weird. Final Fantasy VII, there was that period where everybody was like, Final Fantasy VII is the greatest RPG ever made, bar none, no discussion. And then there was the backlash where people were like, Final Fantasy VII is super overrated.
Yeah.
There are way better RPGs out there. Look at all these problems that it has. And now we've kind of come back full circle where people maybe are appreciating Final Fantasy VII for what it was. I know that's where I am.
I know I consider it a flawed masterpiece, like a heavily flawed masterpiece. But I think it did so much for the RPG genre, especially bringing more people to it, which was... That was a big thing, because until then, RPGs were for stupid nerds and nobody else. And then all of a sudden, like, Final Fantasy VII is one of those games you can refer back to for almost anyone who is a gamer, who considers himself a gamer.
I don't think I want an FF7 remake anymore.
I kind of do. I do.
No.
I do.
You know why I don't want one?
Because it's not going to be...
It's just not going to be the same.
No, of course it won't be the same. But if I know in my heart it won't be the same, I can deal. I can
not only will it not be the same just because the times are different, games are different, and they are clearly setting out to make something very different. Square was different. Square was a different company. This was pre-merger. They had very different people, very different talent working on this game. Many of the originals are coming back. To work on it, no doubt, but it's just not going to be the same. And I appreciate that you can have a new take on it and everything, but I'd kind of rather just let it stand on its own. There are a couple of really good ways to appreciate Final Fantasy VII right now. You can play it PC with all the mods.
That's true.
Or you can play it on PS4, which is a port of, I believe, the PC version, which has like lots of cool little bells and whistles with like being able to fast forward through things. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool for the summons.
Yeah, that's really essential, especially because you couldn't skip through the summons until Final Fantasy IX. Actually, you couldn't even technically skip through them then. They just had shortened versions.
Oh, right. They really wanted to show off their work. Look what we made.
I mean, yeah, that was the problem with Final Fantasy VIII, was that you didn't want to... There was a real disincentive against using summons because they were unskippable and they were too freaking long. Mm-hmm. The ultimate summon was like 2 minutes.
Was it really? I remember Knight of the Round, of course, from Final Fantasy VII was like a minute and a half practically, but which one was 2 minutes in VIII?
Oh, I don't remember. It was the ultimate one. It was the best one you could get. It was longer than Knights of the Round.
Oh my god.
And they always did it where they're like, oh, but you can get this boost ability and hit boost. And then the real joke on everybody in Final Fantasy VIII was that you would get to the final boss, and if you tried to use a summon, they would just destroy it.
I remember. Oh, that was pretty awesome. That's hilarious. Yeah. Great.
So all the people who just relied on summons all game went, oh.
Oh, dear.
Oh, crap. Oh, you weren't playing the game right until now. Well, I got bad news for you.
Well, that's how you know you're in trouble.
The number of contemporary reviews from that time that were like, oh, you could just get through playing with summons, you know, like it's just spamming summons. I'm like, you really don't know anything about this game. Yeah, Final Fantasy VII, 20 years old. Time passes by. Just wait until 25th anniversary. We might be a couple of years away from the remake by then.
If we're lucky. Or we'll get another compilation of Final Fantasy VII. God help us.
God help us. All right, Nadia, we are going to go move on to the interview with the Obsidian folks. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, I am here now at Obsidian once again with Josh Sawyer and also with Fergus Urquhart, who is the founder of Obsidian. Lovely to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Awesome to be here.
If you go over to the site, usgamer.net, you will see that we have a Fallout New Vegas retrospective. We are talking about how Fallout New Vegas became a cult classic. I remember reviewing this or doing the guide for this game at 1UP 7 years ago, which is kind of crazy to think about. And I was just telling Josh off the air that I ended up totally breaking that game, actually, because I was having to play from the perspective of every single faction. But my biggest dream was to infiltrate the Legion, let the Caesar die on the operating table, and then join the NCR. And just be like a turncoat double agent. And if, like, I don't remember if that's possible, but I really hope it is, because that's awesome.
Like I said, it's tricky because each of the factions has their different sort of, like, point of no return for them. And I think that it's possible to do that, but I'm not positive.
I'm probably, I wouldn't say the last person to ask that question, but probably
it,
close
it
to
it gets
the last
tricky because either. When we started working on Deadfire, because we're having a lot deeper faction sort of gameplay, we went back and looked at Bobby Null did not really know how involved the faction stuff was from Fallout New Vegas. Mm. And he looked at it and he was like, oh my God, he's like, this is so complicated. And I'm like, embrace it, Bobby. Like,
yes.
It's cool.
I think the faction stuff, I always thought was so fun because like, I think, you know, and this is where I have to give Josh and everybody else that worked on a ton of credit. It's just like, because a lot of the factions were not set up that you are supposed to like them all.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Caesar's Legion is like the greatest.
Certainly not.
Yeah, Caesar's Legion is a great example. But it's so interesting of the playthroughs because I just went, I'm like back playing Fallout New Vegas again for a game that we're making that's not Fallout. And I wanted to go back and get that experience and see how it was. And it was interesting. So then I tried to play that part multiple ways where I actually talked to him. Other times when I would just shoot him off, like just shoot them right away. And I think that was what was so awesome about New Vegas. It didn't go in with this idea that every faction was going to be... someone that you could potentially you would want to join or be a part of.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at the time, like Fallout New Vegas, like it came out, it was pretty buggy. Like reviews, like it was trouble. There's that famous story of you guys missing out on bonuses by 1 point on Metacritic, which Fergus is like nodding.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. This isn't on video, is it? Yes.
But it, in that time, that it's become like kind of this beloved game, right? Like people, like it has a perfect score on Steam. Like people talk about it kind of reverentially. Like, to what do you kind of attribute that change?
I think a lot of whether it's films or books or games that do wind up becoming sort of cult classics, I think it's because there's something underlying about it that is not really seen at first, at first glance. So, for example, Fallout New Vegas, you know, if you're a player just kind of jumping in it from Fallout 3, or if you're a reviewer who doesn't necessarily have a ton of time to play it, you don't necessarily appreciate that you can become friends with Caesar, execute Caesar on the operating table, jump across the Colorado River, and then, like, join another faction and then betray. Like, you don't necessarily see
the surface as it feels like Fallout 3.
Yeah, the surface.
And not that Fallout 3 is a super simple game, not saying that, but it's just on the surface, like, if you don't dive into it, which takes time, so time is the big thing, then you just feel it's Fallout 3.
Yeah, and so I think it took time for people to realize, like, oh, there's really a lot of different ways that you can go with this game. There's a lot of different perspectives that you can get on things. There are a lot of people who say that their perspective of, let's say, Mr. House is informed by certain interactions that other people don't see. Yeah. Or the NCR. The NCR is so vast that there are a lot of people who are like, NCR are totally good. And other people say, like, what are you talking about? Like, I went here and I saw how the NCR was doing this stuff and they're totally bad.
Yeah.
So I think it took a while and it took communities really talking about this for it to kind of take off and in people's minds and go like, wow, there's like really a lot of stuff going on in there.
And I think that was all like, this is where I give Josh, you know, and the team a ton of credit as well. It's just this idea of, you know, Josh is always a huge proponent of player agency. Like that's like a big thing of like, and the idea of player agency, which you can do in a role-playing game, which is harder to do in other types of games, is really, and that's what leads to, if you say, hey, players can play this game the way that they want to play it. And if they're going to want to play it this way or this way or this way, how do we make the game work to support all of that? And which is a nightmare a lot of the time. And it's funny because I think that's actually there's a couple things that go, this is not in a way to sort of like fluff, like to say something was not a problem, but it's odd when you give all those options, you're sort of inviting bugs because when there's so many things the player can do, how can, like, you can set up like this weird chain of like, you joined A, but not B, but C you killed, but D you did this, and E, and if it's all coordinated, having play testers test that is a challenge. And again, that's not that we try to explain it away or anything like that, but it's like, it's almost like the good versus the bad.
Yeah. Although, can I talk about my favorite bug in Fallout New Vegas?
You can always talk about your favorite bugs.
So there's so many to choose from, but my absolute favorite, which we did catch before launch, there's Arcade Ganon's companion quest is called For Auld Lang Syne, and it's where you go and you talk to all the old members of the Enclave, and one by one you get them to kind of come back together to help with Hoover Dam. And toward the end of that, there's one of the members of the group, Orion Moreno, who hates NCR because NCR destroyed Navarro, and he's like, I'm never going to work with that. Like, and he gets really mad. And so he's waiting for you in a suit of power armor with a, you know, Gatling laser, I think. And, you know, the other remnants, they're like, yeah, I think Orion is kind of worked up. So you go out and he confronts you and he's like, there's no way I'm doing this. You're not making me do this. And you can talk him out of it, in which case he can, you know, join the group. Or you're forced to kill him, in which case, hey, you get some pretty sweet Enclave power armor.
Yep.
And a Gatling laser. So you take it off of him. You know, they say, well, he's not going to need it anymore. But then what happens is...
This is the bug.
You go to the Battle of Hoover Dam. So it's been hours since you've resolved it this way. So you go to the Battle of Hoover Dam, and you go out on top of the dam, and you see Daisy Whitman's Enclave vertebrate fly down, and you see Doc Johnson jump out, and you see Judah Krieger jump out, and you see Cannibal Johnson jump out, and then you see the dismembered corpse of an old man naked flop out onto the bridge, because that's a persistent object in the world.
Yes.
And it doesn't check to see if he's alive or dead. It just says, move.
It knows he's dead.
It moves Orion Moreno to that position, which looks like Cannibal Johnson just threw his body out of the vertebrate. So, yes, the fact that you can kill him or not kill him is, in fact, a source of bugs.
Yeah.
When I look at Fallout New Vegas, like, the thing that kind of screams at me about it is passion project for you guys. Like, obviously, you guys worked on Fallout 2. I mean, you guys worked on Fallout 1 back in Black Isle. Like, it's your baby. And, like, I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, you know, it's, I think a part of it is, I mean, the best thing about getting to work on Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 is that we loved it. Like, it just, it was like, you know, Tim and Leonard, it was Tim and Leonard and Jason, and then Jason Anderson's baby. And And, you know, I was very lucky in that I was able to kind of be there and work on it with them and help them get it done. And, but I would never take, it's theirs. They're the ones who made it. I tweaked around it a little bit. And then, you know, it's interesting though, but like when I think, at least for me, when I left Interplay and Black Isle, I had not left for as long because I was always hoping we could really make Fallout 3. And even though I had canceled the first incarnation of Fallout 3 and became Icewind Dale, when I did that, I kind of closed the door. You know what I mean? I still love Fallout, but it wasn't mine anymore, or I wasn't a part of it as much anymore. And so now it was incredible to get to return, but I think we all knew, or at least I knew, it was sort of like it was getting to take a vacation in Fallout again, but it wasn't something that was going to be a permanent thing that we were going to get to do. But so from the passion of it is, I guess the passion just came from loving Fallout and getting to play in that world again. But it wasn't sort of this, I don't know, for me at least, it wasn't this sort of like overarching, I'm going to kill myself to exist in the Fallout world forever. because I think a cool thing about making games and being an independent studio is we get to go do different stuff. You know, we get to make Fallout and South Park and Pillars of Eternity and Alpha Protocol and all those kind of things. In that way it was great to return, but it's great to be able to do other stuff too.
Yeah. I think in my mind, I had already lost the chance to work on Fallout by the time that, I came to Black Isle and it was like, next project, Fallout 3, next project, Fallout 3.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And I did not expect to ever get to work with Fallout again. And so then when we actually did have the opportunity, in my mind, I recognized sort of as Fergus, like, this isn't ours anymore, but it's a thing that we can, that we love and we can make something in. And in my mind, I always thought, like, this is my one chance to do this.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
And so I just wanted to make one really great, game in that world. And but Fergus is right. Like, we bounce around. We work on different properties, different genres and things like that. Mm-hmm. Genres within RPGs.
Yeah, yeah, with RPGs. Settings, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but no, I mean, that's kind of how I approach it. Is like, we got one shot at this. Mm-hmm. Let's make something really awesome.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the popularity of just Fallout New Vegas in general, or like Fallout in general, like, mm-hmm. why does this world speak to you? Like, what about this this game, like, just keeps drawing people in? Because, like, it's the case with Fallout 4 as well. Like, people are just going to keep playing this into the freaking ground, mm-hmm. and they're still playing your game. Like, mm-hmm. what is it?
I think it's the freedom to explore, the freedom to make so many different types of characters and character concepts and see how viable they are in the world, the places where they don't work. The fact that it is so vast, there's just so much stuff to do. Even in Fallout 1 and Fallout 2, there's just an enormous amount of content to go through. I think a lot of people really love the setting because it has dark humor. And that's always kind of been at the core of it. It's a very grim setting, but it's also full of a lot of, like, sort of dark jokes and just regular old jokes. And that's something that I think, we can sometimes, especially in role-playing, especially fantasy role-playing games, can get very serious. Welcome to serious mode. Uh-huh. And Fallout, it always just had a light side to it, no matter how dark it got. Uh-huh. So I think that's one thing that people really, they like that there is goofiness in it.
Yeah. I think, it's maybe criticism of Fallout 4, but it's not intended. I think, I don't know, it's almost like Fallout New Vegas embraced that feeling from Fallout 1 of the vault dweller walking away from the vault. Like, this, like, you can involve yourself with the Legion and with NCR and Mr. House and all this kind of stuff, but you were kind of this own being. And it's not that you're not in Fallout 4. It's not that you are, like, secondary to the factions, but it's a very strong connection. Like, you have to make a faction decision and you're following these very kind of long, I don't know, it's, I don't want to say longer faction quest things, but I don't know. It feels like I was more me in Fallout New Vegas being this survival, survivalist. And
well, I think that, I mean, a lot of my inspiration for, like, the vibe of your role in it came from Fallout 1 and 2. But also spaghetti westerns, mm-hmm, Yojimbo, mm-hmm. Like the man with no name. Like, the man with no name, he comes into town, mm-hmm. a lot of people die, then the man with no name leaves. Mm-hmm. Like, and he goes. He's not gonna set up a farm. Like, that mm-hmm. dude is leaving. So that vibe, and especially because I wanted to reinforce more sort of like Western ideas overall. Because
that's the vibe. And that's probably the difference, is sort of saying the difference between New Vegas and Fallout 4. What we did was to hook the vibe into the setting and where it took place. And that's not to say like how Fallout 4 did what it did was bad by any stretch of the means. It's just a different game player, you know? And I think it's odd because people would say, well, people are playing Fallout New Vegas instead of Fallout 4. And I think it's just because they both types of people love Fallout, and it's just a different, like, it's your different style of Fallout that you love. And that's it. It's just like it's like subgenres within Fallout, and I choose that I like, do I like cars or Monsters, Inc.? It doesn't want to be a stupid analogy, but I mean, you know, I think that's what it is in sort of like, we all as a group love Fallout, but I want this kind of Fallout experience. I want this kind of Fallout experience.
Sure.
I think another reason that Fallout New Vegas kind of resonates with people maybe is like the shades of gray. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of moral ambiguity going on in this game. Mm-hmm. Like the Brotherhood of Steel, like, I mean, they kind of bring order to the wasteland, but they're really iconoclastic, and they just kind of do their thing, mm-hmm. and they will not brook any,
it's their way or the highway.
Pretty much. There's not, I mean, there are definite bad guys. But even the Legion, you kind of go, oh, yeah, bringing order to, like, a chaotic wasteland, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you can see the good and the bad of everything. And one thing that actually Josh mentioned to me that really kind of resonated with me was that he said, nobody remembers the critical path. Like, nobody goes, yep, I sure did enjoy somebody playing somebody else's story. Like, yes. Everybody has their own story.
Yeah, it's the player agency part, yeah.
Yeah, and New Vegas, like, I think really just gives you a chance to have your own story, right?
Yeah, and this extends to certain decisions that are sort of high level that I said, you know, at the beginning of Fallout New Vegas, I said, or maybe not the very beginning, but pretty early on, I said, you have to assume that after a single conversation face-to-face with an NPC, that the player shoots them in the face. So all of your quests must be constructed with the assumption that that character can die as soon, like right after they get introduced. And it makes it more difficult for the designers. It makes it more difficult for the writers, but it goes to that sense of agency. Like, I can choose, other than children, I can choose to blow away anybody that I come across. And we took that as far, even though it's a little absurd, but it kind of reinforces the point. Even Yes Man, you can kill Yes Man, and Yes Man will come back in a different Securitron body, and he'll say, I'm sorry I made you mad. Like, let's start over. And you can kill that one, and then another one will come back.
Yeah.
But it really is going to that sense of, like, don't, like, really design everything so that when the player pushes, it gives way. Like, the player goes, oh, I am still in control. I do still determine how the story goes.
Right.
I think somebody was wondering, like, why can't you be like a crazy axe wielder running around in their underwear in the wasteland? I'm like, well, you theoretically could in another like Fallout or whatever, but I mean, there's not really an end to that, right?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
But there is kind of an end to that in New Vegas. Like, you could hypothetically do that, kill everybody, and then end up ruling over a dead wasteland.
Yeah, you can go through, and I mean, and we did try to account for that, like, you know, you can go around and just butcher everybody that you come across and encounter Yes Man, have a conversation with him, chop him into pieces, go do what he asked you to do, chop all those people into pieces that he sent you. So he can say, go talk to the Great Khans. And you're like, oh, I'll go talk to him. And then you go to the Great Khans and you chop them in pieces and you come back and you're like, yeah, they're not going to help out. And then kill him. And then, you know, he says, okay, go talk to these people. And you can just go through axe murdering everyone and get to the end of the game. You can do that. And then the end slides will show devastation across the wasteland. Yeah. So,
okay, I wanted to ask you. So obviously, you guys worked on your own Fallout 3. It was Van Buren, and that partly became what ended up being Fallout New Vegas. And one question that I had was: there was some speculation on this front. In your mind, is Van Buren canon? Like, did those events happen in your mind?
No. They were. I mean, you know, I kind of mentioned before, like, Chris Avellone wrote an enormous, you know, Fallout Bible, and he had, you know, just an incredible amount of material for ideas for various elements, factions, characters of what could be Fallout 3. It was way more than like a single story, like way more than 10 stories probably.
Yeah.
So I never really thought like, oh, the things that were going to happen in Van Buren definitely happened in the Fallout universe. What we just said when we approached New Vegas is like, what are some characters and ideas that we liked in Van Buren that we could see in this setting, which is pretty close by? Like, a lot of the Fallout 3 stuff that Avalon had been working on was around that part of the Southwest. Mm-hmm. And so we just said, like, what elements do we want to bring over? What elements are we going to bring over, but we're going to change?
Yeah.
And then we just took it from there. But really, like, bits and pieces came over, but it's not like New Vegas is like a reimagining of Van Buren or anything.
Okay. Really quickly, we're going to do a little bit of a lightning round here going. All right.
Jeez, I'm bad at these.
Favorite quest?
Oh, my God. It's too easy, but I'll say it because I thought it was, Where's the Beef? Beyond the Beef.
That's the cannibalism one.
Yeah. I thought that was just because of like how crazy it could be.
Yeah. I really liked, Come Fly With Me, which is one of the first quests that we did.
The goals and stuff.
Because I actually recently remember Chris Haversham, the guy who said, he was like, I'm becoming a ghoul. And you're like, why? And he's like, I'm losing all my hair. He was bald and that's why he thought he was a ghoul. But like, there were so many goofy things in it. The way that you could interact with there were great characters at, you know, like Nobark Noonan, all the people in the town, the characters that you encountered in Repcon itself. And then the end sequence was really fun. So there's a lot of cool stuff in there as well. So I really like Come Fly With Me.
NCR, Caesar's Legion, or Mr. House?
So I will answer that differently now. It was interesting because I like literally one of the first times when I did more of a playthrough is I just like I would walk into I'm being bad with names today. Where you meet Caesar's Legion in not Novak.
Nipton.
Nipton, yes,
which just
Nipton.
Got bought, by the way, by a company, a weed company.
Bought Nipton.
Yeah.
Wow.
To grow and sell weed there.
To grow weed. Weedton. It'll just be Weedton. Weed by the time. Yeah. So I just shot him right, and you know, and because I'm like, oh, these guys suck, and they're putting people on poles, right? I think the last time I talked to him, and I just thought I thought they were super interesting just because of exactly what you were saying before of like, yeah, they're vicious and horrible and all this other kind of stuff, but there's a purpose to them, you know, and it's not just they're being vicious and horrible to be vicious and horrible. And so I thought that was interesting.
Caesar just wants to have a debate.
Absolutely.
That you die at the end. Yeah, and I'll never answer that question.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. So what Josh is actually saying is that he's a wild card.
No, I'm not saying that either.
Oh, okay. I always picked NCR because I'm boring. And I'm willing
you
to...
You like bureaucrats.
I'm willing to embrace flawed systems. I don't care. Yes, I'm willing to turn a blind eye to all of the NCR's flaws because at least they kind of resemble something good.
Well, and I think more so, and I'm not going to answer for Josh because I don't know his actual answer, but I think if I could almost think of his actual answer, it might be it's himself.
No, it's it's really it's well in the sense that I'm the player. Yeah,
yes,
I mean, because the thing is like
you're your own faction.
To be honest, like I don't actually think about the factions in terms like that.
Yeah,
I think I always think about presenting the factions in a way that like a lot of different people are going to see different things in them. And the reason I don't answer that question is because I don't want the audience to ever feel that my authority, like that there's authorial intent there. Like I want them to feel that whatever choice they made is completely valid. As valid as anyone else's in their mind. And I don't want my sort of opinions, which are actually not very defined, to overwhelm that.
Companion of choice?
You go. I can't. I've tried it.
I would say I like Raoul a lot. Raoul and Cass are both really good. But I mean, I don't know. It's hard.
I like Veronica.
Boone is just so useful.
Yes. Well, Boone is
and he's a great character. I don't think that there is one that I would pick, but I do really like Raoul. I really like Boone.
I probably went around with Boone the most, but what's I guess for me what it is interesting, like, well, I'm a big companion guy in all ever role-playing games ever. Fallout, I like...
Being by yourself.
I like being by myself. I don't know. I like that... You know, I just like the companions to me are like an extraneous.
You don't even bring the dog?
Did I ever bring the, yes.
To be honest.
I think it was interesting, like at least in Fallout 4, I missed him at first. And so
did you miss the dog in Fallout 4?
I don't know.
Holy crap.
Literally, I don't know because I remember everyone was like, because he was at the little gas station, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's like, I don't know. I even went into the gas station. I have no idea how.
Wow.
I mean, I put like, I don't know, 80, 90 hours into Fallout 4. And so, but I was like, I mean, eventually someone told me.
You can lose the dog.
Yes.
But you can get him back. Like,
well, he
you
goes
just
back
need...
to like a dog, like a, to a, to a dog.
A doghouse.
A doghouse somewhere.
Build a doghouse.
And then, yeah.
And then the dog will show up. Nice.
Yes.
Yes.
I would say, and currently that's where he is in my town.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'll say is, like, I think for gameplay reasons, that's the only reason why I tend to not mention, like, Veronica or Lily, because they're really melee-oriented, and I'm typically a guns character, and they wind up, like...
In your way.
In my way. I like those characters. It's just, like, gameplay-wise, I'm like, keep the line of fire clear. Yeah. So I'll have Eddie and Boone, you know, just blasting away at stuff.
Okay. And on that note, preferred build?
I always take guns. Sometimes I like guns, sneak, and explosives. That is, like, I love stealth murder. And so I'll do, like, you know, I'll sneak around and set up a bunch of mines and stuff. And then, you know, blast someone's head. And then they all come running and blow up. And I laugh. And then, you know, just loot their bodies.
You know, it's funny. For me, I generally play... I like to have, like, just... I can be a min-maxer. I think a lot of us are. But I get to be, like, a min-maxer. But, like, how I really try to... The kind of thing I try to build is just sort of like this... Like, heavily armored, medium-range guy. I don't know how to explain it. Like, he's boring. Like, I'll totally... I build boring characters that way. But that, I don't know. That's what I like. I like this. I don't like... I don't always play, like... I don't love sneaky characters. Although, weirdly enough, in Dishonored, I love sneaking in Dishonored. And I'm not the snipe him from 100 miles away.
I am.
I get bored. I don't know. It's weird. I get bored, right? So, I just like the... I want to be this guy just... But, you know, I don't know. I would be the SWAT guy, kicks in the doors, throws the flashbang down, and just murders everybody.
Nice.
That's my...
Yeah, I really
like... my goal in life, no.
I really like to see the combo of, like, I set up a bunch of explosives, and then I, like, stealth start murdering people, and they all start getting really agitated, and then they figure out where they am, I am, and they run at me, and then they blow up, and then I laugh. Like, that's my, like, that's my...
You sound a lot like my son. That's what my son would do.
Nice.
As long as you give me the biggest laser cannon that you can possibly get, and it just turns everybody into piles of ash, I'm good.
That's your thing.
The Tesla-beaten prototype.
Yes, exactly. In Fallout 4, one of my absolute favorite things was the Automatron DLC, because you could get that poor little, like, robot, stick her into the thing, and turn her into a giant killbot, right? Like, with dual Gatling gun lasers and tank treads and, like, missile launchers and everything. And, like, she has, like, the Terminator, like, single eye. No, the Cylon single eye. And you're just like, hello. She's like, you're just like, oh, my God. But she's amazing to have as a companion.
Yeah, I really hope that someone hacks our Spectobot downstairs and makes the eye.
Yeah, we have a security bot.
We have a security bot downstairs. Not Obsidian doesn't have a security bot.
I will say that one of my favorite things in Fallout 4, because I built like 20 settlements and gave them all like missile launchers, was like, oh, this settlement's being attacked. And then I just load in and I just hear like five missiles launching.
Yep,
and then
I'm
like, well, it's done.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Last question. Preferred mods? Or do you go unmodded?
No, what mods would I... I mean, I like... I'm trying to think what mods
I literally only use my own mod.
Yeah, that's cheating.
I made it for myself.
Like, I'll do, like, you know, later on after with all Bethesda games and other games, like, I'll do some texture mods and stuff like that. I'm trying to think... Oh, I know. At least for Fallout 4, I did the dialogue mod, where you can actually see what you're going to say... and choose that before instead of their kind of short, sweet things. I like that.
All right. Any chance that my guys might ever return to the world of Fallout?
It was so awesome to get to do Fallout New Vegas, and it was sort of like this maybe is our only chance. Mm-hmm. If it ever were to happen that we're another Fallout, we'd absolutely talk to Bethesda about it and think about it, but at this point in time, there is nothing on the table where we would be working on another Fallout.
All right. Fergus, Josh, thanks for coming on the show, and you should go check out the retrospective in which I talked to both of them about how Fallout New Vegas became a cult classic. Now, we're going to keep going. Don't go away.
All right, Nadia, we're going to keep it relatively short with the comments today. We just got one. This is from Jero MC, and it's another perfect team, Nadia, all right? This is not a theme team like last week's with the robot, which, by the way, was awesome. This is my favorite one so far. But this one, all right. The leader is Makoto from Persona 3. He's already proven to be a capable leader, and the ability to summon multiple personas make him a jack of all trades, which I kind of like since versatility is always a good thing. I don't know. Picking a persona protagonist almost feels like cheating because they can use all of the summons.
And they're kind of
all of the personas. All right, the mage is Neku plus Joshua. More cheating, holy crap. I mean, since the world ends with you characters can't fight alone, I paired Neku with Joshua, who's basically a god, so they could deal maximum damage. So they're just together as a pair.
This is a very technically adept team.
The fighter, once again, another pairing, Dante plus Dimitri from Project Cross Zone. Mm. I love that pair, and since they fight together as a unit, I decided to put them together, mainly because I love their flashy combos and style. Also, they can deal a lot of damage. Dimitri, of course, being from Darkstalkers.
Right. Okay, that guy. Vampire Man.
Yes. Vampire Man plus Dante.
Hmm.
So it works out they well, because Dante is also a demon. Yes, exactly. Do you never play Darkstalkers?
I did, but God, it's been so long. I just remember the Sasquatch was Canadian, of course.
Of course, you would notice that, Nadia.
How could I not? I'm like, there's more to us than snow, you know. A little bit, not much, but snow.
No, I embrace the snow. I love the snow. I think that I don't say that there's more to Minnesota than snow. No, it's all about the snow.
Everything is snow. We eat snow, we drink snow. We make love to snow.
Ew. Okay, the tank is Magnolia from Bravely Second. Mm-hmm. I loved this fierce and sweet character, and her ability to have jobs would also be perfect for versatility, since she can be basically anything. Yes, she Magnolia is the one with the French accent. Or was it a Quebecois or a French accent?
She had a Parisian accent, and it's funny, because she's from a moon, and of course, the moon people in that game all had French accents, but there was
because,
like,
of course.
Kind of an offshoot tribe that also spoke French, but they were based on Earth, and they had the Quebecois accent.
Quebecois.
My husband says Quebec. It drives me crazy.
And finally, the support is Luigi. He's not a great fighter, but the party needs a comic relief, which Luigi could provide in spades. Also, since he's more scared, he can be on the back supporting the other characters. Mario!
Hey, Luigi, when he's pushed to it, he can screw shit up. Like,
oh, he could do a lot of damage with that vacuum cleaner of his.
He can. Like, I haven't played Mario and Rabbids yet, but he's a sniper. Like, you don't screw with a sniper.
I love that he's a sniper. I mean, Luigi is a sniper. It's just so messed up. You know, I might have to get Mario plus Rabbids after all.
Yeah, my husband's playing it now, and I want to give it a try, too. It looks like stupid fun, but it's supposed to be really good.
I'm in the middle of Metroid and all of the sports games, plus Ooh. Destiny 2, which, by the way, Destiny 2 is pretty good.
Yeah, I read I think it was your Twitter that said that.
Yeah, I'm digging it. The art direction and the graphics are really good. But I promised I wouldn't be talking about Destiny 2 on this podcast, so...
You're safe. Everybody's safe. Read the side.
So, Makoto, Neku plus Joshua, Dante plus Dimitri, Magnolia, and Luigi. What do you think of this team, Nadia?
I think whatever they're going after is totally dead.
Totally dead?
Yeah. Well, he has, like, this superpowered team, and, you know, the bad guy is going to be just, like, flattened.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the characters themselves. And I'm like, oh, Luigi's not really dead, but I guess he deals with ghosts.
Luigi knows ghosts, man.
And of course, we have a vampire and a demon. Neku's dead. Joshua is kind of dead, but he's also a god thing. There's a lot. Oh, and I'm not going to say anything about Persona 3, but there seems to be a real theme of death going on. The theme of Persona 3 was also death.
That's right. The whole Tartarus thing.
Oh my god, I just blew my own mind. I found the theme.
Nicely done.
Nicely done. All right. And Jero also talked a little bit about our fall preview, said that I'll say that I'm really looking forward to playing Xenoblade Chronicles 2, Superstar Saga Remake, and Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon. Also, I loved the original Xenoblade on the new 3DS, and it was what got me to play it, since I don't have nearly as much free time to play on the TV as I have to play on the go.
Good point.
As for another RPG report, I'd love to see you two tackle Nier or Witcher 3, since I have both but haven't gotten around to playing them, so it'd be a nice incentive to finally take them off of the pile. I think we got to play Nier Automata, Nadia.
I actually downloaded it.
Mm.
And I started it, but I'm playing Yi's 8 for now, so...
Yeah. We're about a month away from the SNES Classic coming out. And unfortunately, we've hit the teeth of it, and there are a lot of games I want to be playing right now, but I really want to do, you know what RPG report I really want to do?
What's that?
Secret of Mana report.
Oh, that would be fun. I can't remember. You said you hadn't played it, right?
I have not played it, and I see the SNES Classic coming out as my big opportunity.
I think that would be great. I mean, I don't think it would take us too long. It's not a very long game.
Is it? It always seemed pretty long when I was reading the Nintendo Power strategy guides about it.
Well, that was like in the good old days when time stretched out to infinity. But compared to like Persona 4, it's not quite as long. Not that it's short, don't get me wrong, but you're talking about the 16-bit days when RPGs averaged like 30 hours.
And Nier Automata is also extremely relevant, so I think that there are a couple options.
Yeah,
talking about spoilers, I've been told that that is not a game that you want spoiled.
That's a good point.
All right. Okay, so Axe of the Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold, and many ways to connect to us. Follow us on Twitter, Twitch, Facebook, etc. as U.S. GamerNet. Nadia and I, she is at Nadia Oxford. I am at @_Catbot. We stream every Tuesday and Thursday. We've been streaming a whole lot of Destiny. Mm-hmm. Katie and Mike have become like partners in crime. Like they're always streaming together. I like that, actually.
That's cute.
And of course, we have our other podcast, US Gamer Podcast, our flagship podcast that runs every Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And this past week, we did our review event War Stories, and I told a few, and then I discovered that Nadia's never been to one.
No, that's right. Other than the sort of one for the Assassin's Creed game, but no, I've never like been to a review event. They sound
well. We're gonna have to fix them because they're kind of gross. But you can hear all the details on the podcast. And oh yeah, we also talk about Destiny 2 and Metroid Samus Returns. Oh, and speaking of Metroid Samus Returns, we're gonna have a special guest on the podcast, the US Gamer podcast, next week. You know who's coming back, Nadia?
Jeremy.
The one and only Jeremy Parrish. He's going to be talking about some Metroid with us, which is going to be pretty exciting.
That'll be awesome. I really wish I could be on Retronauts, but he likes people to be there, like, in person.
Mm. Yes. Well, you know, if you want to sit in a kind of a smelly room for 8 hours recording podcasts, he'll totally have you if you can get down to San Francisco.
Oh boy, sitting in smelly rooms, my favorite pastime.
I love recording podcasts with that crew, but I mean, it's literally, you go into kind of a sketchier part of Soma, which is the south of Market area, and it's in this kind of rundown neighborhood, and you go into a shared space, and it's in a vault.
Wow. Yeah, it would be, yeah.
With all of the podcast stuff, you're in this cramped little room. And after 2 hours in there, I just want to get out. I don't know how they do that all weekend. Yeah, it's amazing.
They dedicate themselves then because I've been to live podcasts. Like I did one at Ryerson University, and that was it was like a tiny room, you know, a whole bunch of people, microphones everywhere, smelling up really rapidly.
Yeah,
so it's an event.
Indeed. Okay, so make sure also to check out on Monday the US Gamer website. We're going to have a big retrospective on Fallout New Vegas. Hope you enjoyed the interview. But in the meantime, thanks for listening. We'll be back next Friday, as always. And for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening and happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser Bestes.